Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for November 2018. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breston & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. I'm an intellectual property lawyer. Sometimes I get asked by friends or acquaintances, what's the most exciting invention that you've seen lately? A couple of years ago, the answer was easy. It's CRISPR, I'd say. What's CRISPR, they'd ask. I describe it as an inexpensive, precise tool that can be used to edit genes. And if you can edit genes, then you can change how a cell behaves or what it makes. And if you can change how a cell behaves, you can change how the organism behaves. Out with a bad gene, in with a good gene. Maybe engineer a mosquito so it can't carry malaria. Or edit bone marrow cells in mice to treat sickle cell anemia. History has shown that along with the best inventions, Morse code, the airplane, the photocopier, modern pharmaceuticals, come patent fights between competing innovators. For CRISPR, it's the West Coast versus the East Coast, a group that includes the University of California on one side, and MIT, Harvard, and the Broad Institute on the other. Sarah Kagan is an attorney with Banner and Witkoff in their Washington, D.C. office. She has a Ph.D. and did postdoctoral work in molecular biology. Not surprisingly, her practice is patent-focused. Dr. Kagan has done patent work with everyone from individual inventors, academic institutions, startups, established biotech companies, and pharmaceutical companies. She's done patent work in the areas of cancer genetics and molecular biology techniques, and she's worked to create patent portfolios in the area of cancer immunotherapies and epigenetics. I spoke with Sarah from her office in Washington, D.C.
Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Don.
So for the benefit of our listeners, could you explain what is CRISPR?
So CRISPR is an acronym. It stands for Clustered, Regularly Interspaced, Short Palindromic Repeats.
And what does that mean in the context of biology and genetics?
So it's a system that exists in bacteria that's sort of a proto-immune system where the bacteria can keep track of invaders that it has confronted before so it can recognize them in the future. Mm-hmm. And it does so by keeping a little snippet of the genetic material of some past viral attack, let's say.
And then what's the application of this in terms of applied genomics?
Well, there's been some engineering to improve the system and make it applicable to very easily manipulating the genome of various organisms so that it's easy to, quote, easy, to make changes such as deletions or insertions or substitutions in a precise place that's desired in the genome. So this is a system that's manipulated to be a genetic tool for humans.
So in your update about the litigation surrounding CRISPR, you called it patent wars. So who has the war been between?
The war is between two groups of applicants. One side is the University of California, the University of Vienna, and Emmanuel Charpentier. And the other group is the Broad Institute, MIT, and Harvard.
And where have things happened so far in terms of the interference proceedings that have taken place in the patent office?
So the University of California initiated an interference between its application and the claims of its one application and 13 issued patents and one pending application of the Broad et al. Group. And the board in the patent office began the interference procedure, and it got as far as the deciding an initial motion to dissolve the interference before it really took off. And the board decided that it would dissolve the interference, and so it did. And then the parties appealed to University of California, appealed to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit.
So how did the PTAB set up the interference?
Well, they as they always do, they designate a senior party and a junior party, and they do that on the basis of the early who has the earliest priority date of their applications. And the University of California had the earlier application filing date, so they're designated the senior party, and that gives them some procedural advantages, but it's not an ultimate determination of who was first to invent. The interference is set up to determine who was first to invent, but they start with this initial assumption that whoever is the senior party, because they filed first, would be the winner if the junior party doesn't prove later that it was the first to invent.
So if the interference had proceeded further, what would the PTAB have been addressing?
If it had gone to the priority phase, each party would put on their proofs, whatever evidence they have to show that when they invented the subject matter of the count. So the count is an artificial abstract construct that defines overlapping subject matter between the two parties. So they need not, in this case, they did not have the same exact claims. So the patent office sets up a count that describes the overlapping subject matter. Sometimes it can be the claim of one party or the other party, or it can be in the alternative. So that's how they determine who invented the subject matter of the count, is what would be determined in the priority phase.
Okay. So in the case of UCAL and Broad, what scope of claims had each party applied for?
So the University of California's claims were generic and broad and described using the CRISPR technology in any environment. It wasn't specified in what kind of cells, or whether it was in cells or even in vitro. I believe it was broad enough to be just anywhere. Whereas the Broad claims were limited to use in eukaryotic cells.
So it's my understanding the examiner set up an interference, the PTAB itself struck it down, and we've had a late recent development now from the Federal Circuit. Can you explain what's happened at the Federal Circuit?
Sure. The Federal Circuit gave their decision. It came down in September, and they decided, like the PTAB below, that the subject matter of the claims of the two parties, of the claims that were designated as corresponding to the count, actually were not obvious over each other. So they said there wasn't really an interference in fact, because the claims of one party were not obvious over the claims of the other party, or anticipated, and vice versa. So it's a two-way test, and the PTAB and the Federal Circuit both said that it failed that test because the claims of Broad, the narrower claims, were not obvious over the claims of the University of California, which were the broader generic claims.
So I understand that Broad can now maintain the patents that it has, and University of California, could they go back and try to get narrower claims in the process?
I think they could. They would need to have support in their original application, and they would also be subject to a time bar. So they would need to be within a one-year period after the claims of Broad, the specific claim. So they were within that time period when they originally filed, so it's unlikely now that they're probably still within that one-year period. So maybe they won't do that because maybe they can't do that.
Mm-hmm. And the University of California, I understand, could appeal this decision or try to have this decision appeal to the Supreme Court. Is that right?
That's my understanding. They still have time to appeal it until early December.
So let's talk, if we can, a little bit about the legal bases that surrounded this potential interference. Mm-hmm. When Broad moved to dissolve the interference on the basis of there not being an interference in fact, on what basis did they do that?
Well, again, they said that their claims, the narrow claims directed to the eukaryotic system, use in the eukaryotic system, were not anticipated or obvious by the generic claims. And they said that because, or on the basis of their assertion, which they proved to the satisfaction of both the PTAB and the court, the appeals court, that those of skill in the art would not have had an expectation of success based on what was prior art, which was the Broad teaching about not the Broad, the teaching of about CRISPR in prokaryotic cells. That would not have, there would not have been a reasonable expectation of success for the eukaryotic.
So there was some evidence in the proceeding about the work of six laboratory groups who more or less developed the use of CRISPR in eukaryotic cells using similar processes. How did that evidence factor into the
that was really
PTAB and the court's decision?
Yeah, sorry to talk over you. That was very interesting. So University of California brought in this evidence of six groups that in a very short period of time all successfully got CRISPR to work in eukaryotic cells. And they tried to say that, use that to show that that those of skill in the art, that is those six groups, must have had a reasonable expectation of success because they did the experiment and they got it to work. I'd say the court resoundingly rejected that argument, and they said, if anything, that evidence shows maybe a motivation to try, but not that it showed a reasonable expectation of success. They said that even though it what they tried initially, let's say, worked, so it was turned out to be easy, there was evidence put on by the by Broad that showed that in fact people didn't expect it to work. They thought it would be difficult, and that's what mattered, is what did those of skill in the art think at the time of the invention, what would have been their expectation of success. And so the evidence showed that there was not an expectation of success.
So just because people try something doesn't necessarily mean that they know ahead of time it's going to succeed. Fair enough?
Right.
So how did the court handle the substantial evidence argument in the appeal?
Right. So the challenger, University of California, was arguing that there wasn't substantial evidence to support the lack of reasonable success, a reasonable expectation of success. And the Court of Appeals said no, and University of California pointed out pieces of evidence that they had that were in their favor. And the court pointed out that just because University of California had some evidence on their side did not mean that the other side didn't have substantial evidence, that the existence of evidence on both sides did not negate the fact that that there was substantial evidence on the side that the PTAB had said, you know, had decided on. So the appellate court pointed out that what the appellant, the University of California, was asking was for the appellate court to reweigh the evidence, and it said, that's not our role. We're, you know, if there's substantial evidence, that's the standard, and we will affirm.
There also, based on the Federal Circuit decision, seem to be some self-inflicted wounds on evidence from the University of California inventors themselves, describing the unpredictability, or at least the lack of ability to predict as to whether or not it would work in eukaryotic cells. Is that right?
Yeah. So apparently there were their own statements were among, you know, that wasn't the only thing, but, you know, that I think those were particularly damning.
Mm-hmm. So what do the two parties, University of California and Broad, now walk away with as a result of this non-interference being declared?
Right. So each party, since there's no interference, each party can continue on as they were doing before. So Broad can walk away with their 13 patents in their pocket and their application, and their application, as well as University of California's application, will go back to the patent office, and they both should be processed for allowance. Because in order to get into the interference, they both had to have gotten to the point in the patent office of being allowable subject matter. So now that this obstacle is gone, the one of the potential interference, they should both go back and be processed for allowance.
And probably not live happily ever after. Is that a fair prognosis?
One can guess that they will either have to come to some agreements between each other, or, you know, if they don't do it nicely, they will continue jabbing at each other and by legal means. So the parties will presumably each have one or more issued patents, and for anybody to practice, let's say in the human arena, which is a eukaryotic arena, they will presumably need to use patent rights of both parties. So the parties may cross-license each other, or the parties could, if they don't come to some kind of friendly business agreement, they might continue to attack each other's patents, for example, in a post-grant procedure at the patent office or in district court litigation. For infringement, let's say. Either venue is a place where they can try to eliminate their competitors.
So the saga, I'm sure, Sarah, will continue. Thank you very much for these thoughts.
Oh, thank you very much for talking to me about this. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Don.
Sarah Kagan is an attorney with Banner & Witkoff in Washington, D.C. For further information on Dr. Kagan and her recent case comment on the CRISPR patent litigation, and for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr, LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.